On October 21st, 2015, Stolen Dress Entertainment, in conjunction with Team Fox, brings you the Million McFly March. Fans of the Back to the Future franchise will gather, dressed as Marty McFly, to participate in the largest gathering of Marty McFlys in history and celebrate the Back to the Future films while also raising money for Parkinson's research through Team Fox. More details about the event, as well as links to donate and RSVP for the event, can be found at millionmcflymarch.com. I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1986. The album is Fits Like a Glove. The artist is Howie Mandel. My guest this week is Lee Leshin. Thanks for being here.
Hey, man. I'm excited. This is one of my favorite albums, so, and it really just defines my childhood. So,
see, this is going to be fun, because I will admit, like, it definitely threw me for a loop, because it's not what I was expecting. I feel like I definitely saw some of this when I was a kid, but I feel like there's also some my parents would not have let me watch. So I think my memory of it is incorrect. So it'll be interesting to hear what it was like about you hearing it for the first time as a kid. We're going to do something a little atypical of the show, and we're going to do the promo stuff up top. We're going to remind people at the end, but because I have a charity event called the Million McFly March here in Burbank on October 21st, 2015, go to millionmcflymarch.com for more. It is a Parkinson's fundraiser. Because we're doing that, I wanted to do something of a tie-in because you are producing an amazing-looking movie called Back in Time.
Yeah. Back in Time is the feature-length documentary that looks at the cultural impact the franchise has had on the public over the last 30 years. So it's just been a great journey. It's been a couple of years, and we've submitted the final cut. You know, we have the final cut to the studio. The studio is Gravitas Ventures for our domestic distribution. It'll be available on Netflix and in select theaters and iTunes and all that stuff. October 21st. October 21st for Netflix.
Awesome. That's exciting. So I know what I'm going to be doing that night once we're done with the march. Because I'm going to have to chill the hell out for a night, and then I leave town. It's going to be such a... Boy, oh boy. It's going to be an interesting thing. So, first of all, how long did it take to make?
The first Kickstarter was, I believe... and this is where you're really going to... You need the director on the phone, Jason Aaron, because I joined the project 6 months into it, but it started, I would say, July of 2013. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that was the first Kickstarter, which was just the guys going up to a guy named Bill Shea's house in Hubbardston, Massachusetts. And it's this Disneyland of movie props, in a sense, in the middle of nowhere, mostly dealing with Back to the Future, but it's phenomenal. He's got not only does he have a replica of the A car, you know, the original car from the first Back to the Future, but he's got the actual screen used Back to the Future 3 DeLorean with the white wall tires on it.
Not holy
the
crap! Country.
Yeah, it's. I mean, and I've been in the thing, and I've ridden in the thing. It's exactly as special as you think it would be. Is the best way I can say that. People ask me, what was it like? Well, I mean, it's not like you go fast.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
These cars, you turn the key and the engine coughs. It's really, we got up to maybe 8 miles an hour, as we moved it from the garage and put it into position for the backdrop for the interview. Mm-hmm. He's also got Marty's truck, which was from 2 and 3.
Oh, that's fantastic.
The first one was given away in a contest. The second one, a guy had it. We believe it was part of a Mexican drug cartel.
Holy shit.
It was drug running. And then there was a Denver Broncos fan out west who bought it. I don't know if it was a drug running car. I don't know how he got it.
Uh-huh.
But once he got it, he painted it orange. the Denver Bronco orange and blue on the inside. And then, so when he sold it on Craigslist, he sold, the Shays got it, and they completely stripped it down, and they remade it to look exactly the way it was.
Wow.
Screen accurate. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
How did they do the research to know it was the right one? That's kind of blowing my mind a little bit.
How did the Shays do
the
research? Well, you get it from a reputable auction house.
Sure. Okay, so it was an auction. Okay, all right. So that
that was an auction, and that was $550,000. It's around $550,000.
Woo.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dedication, man.
Very, very, very dedicated. I don't know if you can hear what's going on outside. It's
Mm-mm.
New York City windows here, so they're very, very, they're very, they're very thin. You don't hear anything outside?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Well, if we're lucky, we'll get the screamer. There's a guy who comes down the street.
Oh, no.
Usually around, I mean, we're not going to get him now. It's too early, but we usually get him around 11:30 once or twice a week. And he just, it's like you read about, when you see in movies, in New York City, they're crazy people. I got one. It came with the apartment, I think. And the guy, he goes there, he walks down the street. He goes, yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Are you certain that it's not Doc Brown? Are you sure?
No. It's definitely not Doc. If I hear him again, I'll record it and I'll send it to you. You can throw it in there.
That's
I don't know his name, so we can't get in trouble for anything.
Sure. No, exactly. that's crazy. So it comes. It comes out on Netflix on the same day as the March 10/21/2015. For those of you guys who don't know, if you're somehow not fans enough of the movie to know that that's when Marty McFly goes into the future, that's the day he goes to in the future. So the movie comes out on Netflix that day, and I apologize. What were the other dates?
I don't know. I want to say it's like 60 days later, it might come out on iTunes or something like that. But,
okay.
But again, these are better questions for Jason.
For
I should
sure.
know this stuff.
Okay.
You produce a movie, there's a lot of things that get in the way after,
Yeah,
you can only hold so much in your head until you start losing phone numbers and people's birthdays.
Oh, I know how that is. Believe me.
Yeah. Yeah, you do.
I also should. There's one other thing that is related. On the 26th of this month, which is a Saturday, A Drinking Game, which is a show I'm in every month. We have not done Back to the Future in a while, but we are doing Back to the Future. It's a stage reading. We do these each month of an 80s or 90s movie. We're doing a stage reading of that. We get drunk. The audience gets drunk. So if you guys come out to see that, you will see yours truly playing Marty McFly, as I do every time.
That's terrific. I'd love to see that.
So that's going to be a ton of fun and a very drunk time. But there will be a presence for the Million McFly March there too, so that the drunk people, before they get drunk, will have access to the information they need. And I will do my best also, provided I'm not drunk yet, to make sure to pimp your film at that thing too, because it's, I'm really excited to see this. Because we're gonna getting totally off topic. We haven't even gotten on topic yet. But like one of the reasons we're doing this where we're doing it, which is at the Burger King, the first real world location using Back to the Future, is right down the street from me. We're doing it there, and one of the first things I did when I moved out here for my first 5 weeks, one of my best friends Ray was like, "Hey, do you want to go to all the Back to the Future locations we can find?" And I said, "Hell yes!" And we went to all of them. This one just happens to be down the street from me. But that's kind of that's one of those things that I'm madly obsessed, so I'm excited there's a movie coming out about fellow obsessives. So
it's funny, we didn't do the location tour. And I think we were trying to be respectful of the privacy of the house where Marty was, but I dig it, man. I in New York I get I don't get starstruck. I get location struck. I'm a few blocks away from where the Cosby Show townhouse was filmed in the West, the exterior.
Uh-huh.
It's supposed to be in Brooklyn Heights, but it's just down the street. The this is not a big one for me, but Carrie's house from Sex and the City, that's
supposed to be up
the side. That's a block and a half down the street, so there's always people taking photos and stuff. So it's cool. I completely understand the connection and that people have, whether it's with film locations or movie props, to the movie.
I should have a little more respect. I did take some of the bark off the tree where George McFly sneaked a peek at Lorraine. I had to.
It's fine. That's actually not the original tree. They replaced it with a fiberglass one that looks exactly like it. They replaced the bark every 2 weeks.
So. See, there we go. If I'd have known that, I would have felt a whole lot better this whole time. Thank you so much, Lee. That's so kind of you. So let's skip forward a year, 1986.
Yeah.
Howie Mandel's Fits Like a Glove. And I'm going to tell you, I was more than shocked. All right, I'm just full disclosure. This is not my type of album, but that does not mean I can't discuss it in a. I want to know first of all what your first impressions were as a kid, and I want to know how it affected you because this is. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of really funny shit in here. There's a couple times I'm like, holy, that came out of. I didn't realize this was that Howie Mandel was ever this guy.
Right. Well, that's the funniest thing. I mean, everybody knows him now from Deal or No Deal or from America's Got Talent, where he's got to be this cookie cutter vanilla guy.
Yeah.
And it's upsetting to me because he doesn't do his old stand up stuff.
Sure.
I mean, as far as I know, because I think the audience that would go to see him now expects this cookie cutter vanilla guy.
Oh, 100%.
I'm expecting something different because I've been listening to the guy since this album. Mm-hmm. I was 8 years old. I don't know if it was my brother's album first or it was my dad's and somehow I got it.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember listening to this and then eventually this got me into him. And then my friend Jason Greenberg and I, when we were kids, would go to Blockbuster Video. We were about 13 years old, I would say, 12, 13 years old, and we would rent Howie's stand-up special.
What's your name? What's your name? What's your name? I've asked you 3 fucking times! Pardon me, what is your name? Mike, and what do you do, Mike?
I'm a student.
You're a student, and what are you studying? What are you studying?
Law.
Law? And are you really studying law? You just sit at home and pick the winners on People's Court? What's your name?
Ed.
Ed? What do you do, Ed? You're a salesman. What do you sell? Seafood. Just like door to door? You say, hi, I'm Ed, I got crabs. I'm talking to somebody.
Because we had heard, I mean, when you listen to this album, you know, you hear him making all these noises.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's no visual.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are these people laughing? I mean, he's just making these noises.
Yeah.
So we get the tape, and I mean, I don't know why we didn't just buy it, you know, because we rented that at least 30 times. I mean,
holy
at least.
Shit.
And it was always that fallback to, okay, there's nothing here. Let's just get the Howie Mandel thing. And we knew it backwards and forwards and we were doing Bobby's voice, everything. I mean, and what I loved about it is his crowd work. I mean, and on this, it's mostly crowd work.
Oh, yeah.
It's
that was one thing I noticed too. I was like, what the, oh, okay. I really expect, I mean, cause he starts off kind of dad jokey, and then eventually,
right.
Yeah, it does become almost 100% crowd work.
Exactly, and he's not really doing bits. It's sort of like, it's almost like he's got this file cabinet in his head,
mm-hmm.
of stories and jokes. I guess like we all do, and then
sure.
Something that an audience member says triggers that, and then he says it, and whether it's true or false, he just delivers it in that way that only a comedian can. What's that that Edwin saying? Comics say funny things, comedians say things funny.
You're right.
This guy's a true comedian. You know, he knows how to go into that well, and he just knows how to make everything funny immediately. You know, I mean, what's your name? John, I just pissed in you. You know?
Right,
I mean,
right.
One of those, like, you know, oh, Bob, but you spell it backwards. Things like, I mean, those things have been ingrained in my head my whole life, you
mm-hmm.
know. I've definitely stolen his jokes every once in a while, especially
sure,
as a kid.
Sure. Right, right, right.
I mean, you know, I mean, I we talked offline before this, you know, I grew up sneaking into comedy clubs. You know, I loved the way that I never saw Howie because he was too big already.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, I was sneaking to Catch a Rising Star on the comic strip on the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, you know, I was 13, but for, you know, my bar mitzvah, best bar mitzvah, Bar Mitzvah gift ever was my brother giving me a fake ID from Times Square.
Holy shit.
That said I was 18. And I got booted out of Dangerfields, actually.
Really?
If I remember correctly, I got booted out of Dangerfields. But I would go to Catch and just sit in the back and watch all these guys.
Wow.
And see guys, you know, that like, I don't know if you know Al Lubell. He was
I do know the name.
Yeah, he was one of my favorites growing up. There was another guy, Chris Rush. I don't know where Chris is now.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Think you know.
I have one of his albums.
He's great. I saw him at a comedy club on Long Island growing up, and my mom took me. And yeah, he was a little dirty, but, you know, and my mom was somebody who took 50 cents off your allowance every time you cursed. her sides were splitting.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, so... Yeah, I forgot the original question, to be honest, but but Howie was somebody who really kind of introduced me to different types of humor, and that I just absorbed. But it's funny because listening to it again now, there's a bunch of jokes that I realize I did not get as a kid.
Sure, sure. You know, I mean, when's the last time you think you heard this?
I haven't heard this. I don't know if I've heard this album. I've heard the one that, or I've watched the one that I rented more recently. But this, it's probably college, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe before that. And even then, it was kind of half listening.
Yeah, yeah, no, 100%. Yeah. You think you remember all of it.
I was listening and I was taking notes during it because I wanted to make sure I was prepared for you. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, he says the thing where, you know, and the waiter came. Ooh, I said the waiter came, you know, and it's like, and makes a nice hollandaise sauce. None of this stuff I got when I was a kid, you know. I would just imitate it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that type of thing. Kevin Pollak. You ever read Kevin Pollak's The Usual Suspect?
Uh-uh.
He's got a great one where he talks about, that's a great read, but he talks about... performing, you know, and learning a comedy album. I want to say it was Bill Cosby, I'm not sure, but knowing it back to front and then performing it, you know, much like Billy Crystal in 700 Sundays, he talks about going up to the Catskills and seeing guys like Henny Youngman and things like that, and then remembering it and then using his family in the act and then completely offending them, but delivering, you know, and he's saying, this I can do, you know, I mean, yeah, so there's guys like that who I identified with because I did that. I mean, I knew Bill Cosby himself. I didn't know him himself. I knew the album himself. I knew that backwards. I still remember it starts off with dentists. I mean, I just remembered those things. And then I would go to the dentist and I would do that bit for the hygienist with the stuff in my mouth, you know. Ruby KB. You know.
That's hilarious.
anyway.
So, all right. So we know you're not sure exactly how you got a hold of it. So it does not sound like the kind of thing your parents would have necessarily, maybe they would have had, but wouldn't have wanted you to listen to.
I don't know. Actually, you know, the album cover had a guy with a rubber glove on his face.
Right.
It looked like a child, and it was pink. It looked like a children's, and the way he's dressed.
100%.
You know, I might have suckered my mom into it.
Mm-hmm.
Into it. I don't know. I don't know why I knew, but maybe I saw the guy in the, on the cover with the thing on his face and thought, oh, that's for me, you know, I want that. And then, I mean, but I used to listen to Andrew Dice Clay and you know, just under the covers, you know, like most kids age, once you got a Walkman, you were golden, you know, and you could copy the tapes, you could trade the tapes, all that stuff. So, I mean, once you figured out how to push out the little button that you could, okay, now it's
copyright,
you know, whatever. That was recordable, excuse me, yeah.
He's got, that was the one thing that struck me. I'm like, he's kind of, at moments, there's like, he's basically Canadian Andrew Dice Clay. There's a few times when he's just downright some of the filthiest stuff I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really, he did push boundaries, but he pushed, you know, you also have to listen, factor in the audience.
Sure.
I mean, the other one that I loved growing up was Gallagher, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at it, I mean, I think it's the same audience, to be honest, because I'm remembering the outfits, you know, that I saw in the crowd.
Right.
I'm remembering the mustaches and this audience, it was a different type of comedy than their parents were used to from the Catskills. And it was a younger audience of, you know, 80s people. Everything had to be about being cool. And so it was like, oh, the dirtier you were, the cooler you were.
For sure.
I think there was a trend with that. And, you know, a lot of the more successful comedians of the late 70s and the 80s, the Richard Pryor's, Eddie Murphy's, you know, they were filthy, but they were great.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so this guy was I think he was just doing what everybody else was doing that he saw doing in America. And he said, well, you know, I think I can do this. And I think he has this, and he claims to never have never done drugs. You know, I mean, when I was listening to this, I said, this guy's on coke.
Oh, 100%.
You know, but he claims, so let's take him at his word for it. If that energy, if that persona is inside you, the only profession is comedian.
That's
the only thing
true.
You can do is to be a comedian or a psychopathic killer. That's it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, he says a few naughty words. Fuck it. It's funny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do you, okay, so from this album, well, first of all, do you have a favorite bit on this album?
I think I do. The farting rape whistle. Just because I had one. But okay. I had one because of this. You know, I got this this fart machine that he calls the farting rape whistle. And I guess in the 80s you could joke about that, but I don't know why it was successful, but mm-hmm. I remember what this thing felt like in my hand. I remember how to manipulate it to make different fart noises. I mean, he turned me on to that. That's probably one of my favorite bits. The bit in the bathroom with the chocolate bar.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so here's the thing. I was definitely influenced by Howie with things like this. So the bit with the chocolate bar where he rubs on his hands and he sticks his hand under the stall next to him and he says, hey man, you got a towel? You know,
yeah.
Things like that. So I definitely did that.
Oh my God.
You know, I mean, because when you're a kid, you can have balls because it's like, well, what are they going to do?
Right.
I'm 12, you know? I remember I was we were in Miami, in some resort in Miami with my family. And there was a gift shop with mannequins outside the shop set up to look like a family at the beach.
Uh-huh.
And I'd never seen that, you know, outside, living in New York and Long Island. Mannequins belong in windows, you know? And so here it was. It's out in front of the store. Nobody's manning it. Nobody's outside. And there's a space between like the mom and dad mannequins. So I waited until there were too many people walking by and I just stepped into the scene. I had sunglasses on, so because I knew that would give me away. So I stood there for about 20 minutes. People walking by, not noticing. Some people noticed, stopped to look. Occasionally there would be a crowd, but then they all dispersed. And I'm trying to keep a straight face and I'm thinking, this is so Howie. He would do this. This is like the thing on the airplane when he puts the Howie and his buddy put on the pilot and co-pilot uniform.
Right.
You know, they walk down the middle of the aisle and they say, "Oh my God, I thought you were driving." You know, I thought you were flying. So that's what I'm thinking. I'm like, "Oh, this is great." So I'm standing there thinking, "This is exactly what he would do." And you know, eventually my dad walked by, did a double take, and then you know, jig was up, and he pulled me out pretty quickly. But Howie, then I'm watching AGT. I'm watching America's Got Talent. I don't know if you watch the show or not, but I'm watching it, and they do a thing at the Wax Museum here in Times Square,
uh-huh.
where they pretended to have an America's Got Talent set with Howie, Mel B, and Heidi, and they all just kind of they're painted a little bit to look like wax figures, and they sit there very still, and then these fans come in and they want to take pictures, and of course. They scare them or they change.
That's fantastic.
You know, they change. So I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I was influenced by Howie and now he's doing the same thing. Maybe he walked by in Miami Beach and said,
yeah, right?
20 years, buddy, I'm going to do this.
Did you work today, Bernadette? Yes, and what happened today? Like, what, give us like one of the thrills of today. What happened? You got in a shipment of Nikes. Ooh. How did you live through it? Bernadette, and you're here tonight. Wow. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Wow. This woman got an entire shipment of Nikes. Wow, the people you meet on the road. I hate performing on the road usually because the cars drive by and they splash over you.
I feel like though you were the kid that Tipper Gore would have loved to find. This kid was poorly influenced by media.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. What was the who was the ode to Tipper Gore? It was. Oh God, and I'm cheating. Warrant. Warrant did a thing on the cherry pie. I'm ode to Tipper Gore. And it was all curse words. And stuff. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's to me, it didn't have to be dirty. It just had to be funny.
Sure.
And I think that's anybody who loves comedy like you and me. I think that's the rule. You know, if you're going to work blue, you better bring the funny.
Oh yeah, because, absolutely.
That can't be an excuse for it. And it's funny when he throws it in there, and especially when he throws it in with. When he's working the crowd, because in some way that I feel that makes it more personal to the audience and to the listener. You know,
it's interesting too. Do you know when you first was this your first exposure to him? No, you said that you'd. I mean, you probably did. You watch St. Elsewhere? Was it where else were you exposed?
This was my first exposure.
It was okay.
I still haven't seen St. Elsewhere. Mm-hmm. This was my absolute first experience with him. I want to say. Maybe my brother, I heard either him trying to imitate Bobby or his friends were imitating Bobby.
Okay.
And maybe that's how it came to be. I don't know. Bobby was definitely a big, and I was saying, you know, blah, blah, I don't bother to blah, blah. You know, I mean, it was, you know, which is not Bobby's voice. But as a kid, I'm thinking, wait a minute, you can make money doing this?
Yeah, right.
You know?
Because at least at the very beginning, in the first, let's say the first act of the whole album, he's definitely, I mean, the crowd work seems to be the one thing that he can use to get a grip on this audience, because he's getting celebrity laughs at the beginning, which is fine, but like, that's where a lot of this is, like a lot of the laughs are like, they're screaming, and he's having so much fun with these people screaming.
Yeah, and he's screaming back, and I'm just thinking... You're getting paid, man. You know, and we do panels for the movie, promoting the movie. You know, if I just stood there and said, "Ew," you know, I mean, I'm not doing my job.
Right.
You know, this guy made that part of his job, and I gotta say, I really just don't think that the sophistication of the audience back then was at the level that it is now. I mean, a Ricky Gervais would not have worked back then. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, even a Louis C.K., the stuff he does now wouldn't work. I mean, it's pretty plain everyman stuff, but it's intelligent comedy. And, you know, you wouldn't catch Ricky or Louis screaming on stage. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, he gets those laughs at the beginning, and I'm cracking up because it's like, you know, all he's thinking in his head is, you know, sure, guys, you know, I got a solid 42 minutes. The more you laugh, the quicker I get out of here. You know, I mean, the more you scream at me when I'm screaming at you, you know, the easier to get out of here alive.
That was the one thing too. That was besides the obvious kind of there's definitely like a Robin Williams influence, or at the very least, they're very similar dudes mentally because of his free association. But the other thing is that you're right; he did have this kind of. This thing that not a lot of comics have anymore and didn't have then, which is that it clearly has a joke file in his head and is ready to go. And that, in and of itself, is an impressive feat, because he had, even though they're clearly a bunch of dad jokes and very, like, shticky, they're definitely, he had them loaded.
Well, yeah, I mean, like when he says to the one kid, what do you do? And he's a student. I'm a student. What are you, studi? You know?
Right.
I when I heard that today, I... remembered it again. Oh my goodness, I forgot the way that how he uses language and words, and you know, how he can say, I hate performing on the road because the cars drive by and they splash you.
Right.
Or just last week, okay, I guess 3 weeks ago, you know, things like that. He had that thing about the two guys walking into a bar. He said, two guys walk into a bar, which is really stupid because you figure out the first guy walked in. You got to think the second guy saw him hit the bar.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, it's those types of you can dissect his stuff You know, it's like if you were a comedian or if you were a student of any sort of comedic writing, listening to his stuff, it's like sitting in on a master class with Professor Mandel. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because if you can trick your brain, I think, into thinking the way he does, you'll be a very good comedian. You know, especially, and I know they say crowd work is the easiest work to do, but shit, if it works, and it makes the people laugh. The people are there to laugh at jokes. The people go to a comedy club and they spend their money and there's an element of escapism. So if you make them laugh and you release that dopamine, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't matter. I live a few blocks away from the comedy cellar here in New York, mm-hmm. and I love to go there like on a Tuesday or Wednesday. And you get to see, you get to see the celebrities that pop in and try the new stuff, but you get to see these people just in there working the crowd, and it's not a packed audience every night.
Sure.
You know, it's almost packed. I mean, the Comedy Cellar is definitely one of the top clubs, if not the top one now, but I mean, you see these comics come in there and you see them do their crowd work, and you can see it's like boot camp. They're just going through the motions to get themselves better. To make this, to have that answer, what are you, you know, your student, what are you studying? They just want to have those answers. They're building their own file cabinets. It's fascinating to watch.
It is. And there are, honestly, I mean, there are people, I know that there is that perception that it's easy, but there are a lot of bad crowd work. People just can't do it. There are guys who are experts at it, like Jimmy Pardo, who's a genius, and they just knock that shit out of the park. So, I mean, it's an underrated skill. To be sure.
Yeah, and was it Todd Barry? I think just did that movie. I think it's just called Crowd Work. I've watched it a few weeks ago. It's terrific.
I've been wanting to see that.
You know, it's great. It's terrific. It's just, it's just him, no prepared material. Well, I mean, but that's what he says, you know. So, if Howie did this and said there's no prepared material, he went in and he did a whole thing on crowd work, and he got a student. He said, "What are you studying?"
Yeah.
Well, that is prepared material.
For sure.
You know, so I guess, but it really just comes off very, very naturally. Todd's a genius. Mm-hmm. I mean, Todd's another one that I've seen come up, and it's been such a joy, literally since I'm a kid, to watch him.
That's so crazy. Now, have you ever done or tried stand-up?
Okay, so I did once.
Okay.
And it out of a 0 to 10, I give it a solid 3.
Uh-huh.
So I had an issue with, I had funny stuff. I had funny material written. Basically, I was in a sketch class, and I was writing a lot of sketch stuff, and the sketch stuff seemed to flow pretty easily.
Uh-huh.
And one of our students ran an open mic night, and she said, you know, anybody want to come out? And everybody kind of shy, so we said, well, I'll do it next week. And then, so for the next week, any one-liner I never thought of, I wrote down and I just said, okay, let me see. And the problem was, I didn't do it off book. That was very Canadian. Off book. I just did it, you know, I kind of just held the paper right in front of my face.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and it was the stuff that was the ad-lib stuff that got the biggest laughs, much like a Craig Ferguson type. It was like a Craig, if you remember Craig Ferguson stuff at the beginning of his Late Late Show, versus how he ended. His comedy was so much better when it was just straight off the cuff stuff.
Right.
And I think if I ever got into it, I'd have to have just bullet points of what I want to talk about. Because if I tried to remember every word like I did that night, it would just be a failure. I'm not against doing it, you know, again for fun. But,
sure.
I think if I ever really delved into comedy as a profession, I would hope it would be more as a writer.
Right, definitely. So how do Howie's other albums compare to this one?
I wish I knew his other albums, really. I mean, I just can't think of it. I know I've heard everything.
Yeah.
You know what you can do? And actually, I want to tell your viewers about it. If you go on YouTube, there's, it's like the Watusi tour.
Uh-huh.
And it's an HBO special, but a lot of the jokes are the same that aren't obviously the crowd. It's a different crowd. But you can see some of these visuals. And I think that the audience would really benefit from seeing it. I know I'm going to watch that tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm going to watch it again tonight because it's I miss it.
See, and that was my thought too. Is like I'm thinking, well, there's the rubber glove is his signature thing, and that's the one thing I'm missing. You know?
Yeah, no, he doesn't do it. No, I don't know. I forget when the doctor said, "Hey, you got to quit that." But you know, there was a doctor that said you're going to blow your sinuses.
Yeah.
Or whatever. I don't know, but you know, to me, that's it's funny, it's original.
Sure.
But after you see it once.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'd rather have him tell funnier jokes, or his brain is the beauty. His brain is the gold mine, you know, and yet it thought of the rubber glove thing. But I'd like to see what he's, you know, I want to just, what are you thinking right now?
Right.
Because he's one of those guys who, I mean, he's just so fast. Mm-hmm. He's so fast, you know.
Why don't you say that loud? Are you undercover tonight? Bob, the cop. You're not undercover? So, what kind of police? What division are you in? FAA. That's Air Traffic Federal Aviation. Isn't that what that is? So, you pull planes over because they're going too fast? An air cop. There you are, you're sitting on a DC-10 and Bob pulls up. Pull over. There he is on the wing writing a ticket. But I was only doing 620. That's great. Well, you're an FAA cop. What's been going on lately? Shit, scary. Do you know anything about that? Is it really safer to sit in the back of the plane? It is? Because the mountains are up front.
That's the one thing, too, is like by listening to this and knowing what I know of him and having read some stuff that he's written, I never finished his book, but I did read the opening to it where I'm like, yeah, 100%, we have the same form of OCD. His is just a lot stronger. That's right. Where a lot of this free association comes from, is from having OCD and at least learning to harness it, which is, that's what's so crazy about it, is it's just like you were always making connections whether you want them or not, and this is the best right. way to shit them out, you know?
Right. No, and it's funny because when you're in sketch class, you know, what everybody reads their own sketch, or excuse me, they have the class read it, but then when it's done, you get feedback, and mm-hmm. it's terrific. The People's Improv Theater, how they do it over here, it's great. They, you know, because you learn about heightening, and you learn about taking, you know, you've now heard this sketch you've never heard before, and now all of us sitting around the table as comedy writers are thinking, well, how do we heighten that? And that I think shows the mind of a good comedian is somebody who can just heighten on their own. You know,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of an example that from this album, but I as far as the quickness of thinking, I just remember him saying something about the guy who works in the hotel. And he says, well, are you one of those paper ribbons that just goes around the toilet seats?
Oh, right.
In a million years, I never would have thought of that.
Sure.
I would have thought of other things. Mm-hmm. And to find something truly funny, because I'm not, you know, an active stand-up, I think it would take me a while. This guy just thinking, it's like he's just so fresh. He's so raw and it's ready to go.
Yeah.
You know?
Were you already really super into stand-up at this point? Because it sounds like it's around the same time that you were getting into this stuff.
Yeah, I started listening to Howie, to Bill Cosby, Steve Martin. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember who else. I mean, I had a whole wall of tapes.
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy, of course, Pryor, you know, but... when I started going to comedy clubs again, I was probably 12 or 13 when I went the first time with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
After that, and what was I loved? He used to love taking me to comedy clubs because the comedians would always pick on me, you know. And I didn't mind sitting up front, you know. Again, yeah. I'm 12 or 13. What are they going to do? You know.
Of course.
And it was the same line. Everybody's in there saying, you know. Who brought this kid? I mean, you know, what kind of parenting? And it was funny, you know.
Yeah.
These people are going to goof on my parents. I'm gonna let them, you know.
Absolutely.
But I think it was the guys that I was, Mike Birbiglia, guys like that I would watch, and that was a little later. But it was guys like that I would watch, and just how are these guys not billionaires? You know, because
right,
they were so.
Right.
It was New York City comedy in the '80s. There's a documentary on, I think, Vimeo, now, and it's about the comic strip, and I'm dying to watch it.
Oh, that sounds
comedy
awesome.
In the 80s in New York City was so amazing, and I was so happy to be a part of it, even as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I would have loved to have been in my 20s or 30s.
Sure, sure.
Back then. And because then I probably would have had the stones to really try it, you know, because
right.
of all these other guys. And, I mean, look, most of them are Jewish. Most of them are from New York. I'm Jewish. I'm from New York. You know, Jerry Seinfeld grew up in Massapequa,
uh-huh.
2 towns away from me. You know, I mean, it's like, I can do this.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it would have been a blast back then because,
for sure,
you know, New York was the epicenter. There was no internet. You know, it was just you got big on your own laurels. And, you know, if the club owner liked you, you were golden. And,
definitely.
And it's just a really cool way. And then you still had Rodney. You still had Dangerfield. You still had mm-hmm. Rodney there. You know. He didn't kick me out. I was always hoping. You know,
if you're going to get kicked out.
Hey, what are you doing in here?
That would have been amazing. Now, have you ever been present for any comedy recording, something that's gone on to be an album
no,
or anything?
No, I never have. I have been present for things that were being rehearsed for comedy recordings.
Okay.
The Comedy Cellar over here, it really is great on like a Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
We saw Aziz Ansari come in a couple times. I've seen Louis C.K. a couple of times. And they're always working on new stuff, you know. And,
yeah.
it's great to see that because, you know, even their new stuff that they, you know, Louis had literally just gotten off the plane. He was sunburned. He said, I got off the plane with my family. My family is probably still in a cab on their way home. I had to come here and do this because I wrote it on the plane. I had to get it out of me. You know? That's just brilliant. That's
yeah.
just, I mean, then you're sitting there and you're saying you're part of this man's history now. You know,
yeah.
it's just, ugh, that's the goal. But no, I've never been there for a taping. I thought I was at the Will Ferrell "You're Welcome, America" taping, but I wasn't.
Oh shit!
because a buddy, I saw a buddy of mine in the audience, because there were cameras going around.
Uh-huh.
I saw a buddy of mine in the audience on the HBO special. So I called him and I said, what day did you go? And because I don't see myself. And he says, no, it was a different day.
Oh.
Sorry for that anticlimactic story.
Before I came out of here tonight, I was in the men's room and I don't know if you're still here, but one of you guys was in the next stall and I had a chocolate bar in my bag and I took it out and I rubbed it all over my hand and I stuck my hand underneath to your stall and I went, hey man, you got any toilet paper? I'm always doing shit like that. Like 2 weeks ago, I went to a porno movie and I took a squirt gun filled with Jergens lotion.
Howie!
What?
I want to touch you.
Pardon me?
I want to touch you.
You want to touch me? With your lips on my dick? I love you too. Pardon me?
Okay.
Well, that's settled. It's been a great relationship.
Do you have any? Well, let's talk about this just because I'm interested because I don't have a lot of people who have the kind of access that you have to. You know, I don't have a lot of guys in New York coming on the show. So we're a different kind of stand-up town here. Not that there aren't a lot of shows, but it's a very different and it's got a different history in terms of stand-up. I'm curious, like. Comics that you've seen over the years that are your favorites or maybe some that are coming up now or are there any that like even resemble the type of humor Howie Mandel was doing at the time?
Oh, that resemble the humor that Howie... I mean,
yeah, anybody who might seem to have
been
influenced.
A comedy scholar can really probably answer that better than I can. I really dig, obviously, Amy Schumer.
Yeah.
Schlesinger, I like her.
Mm-hmm.
God, who else? I love Hannibal Buress.
Oh yeah.
I think he's terrific. Not just at the roast of Justin Bieber, but I've seen him, you know, live and say he's terrific. You know, I worked for a talent agency. My first job out of college, I worked for a talent agency, and
uh-huh.
I was in the voiceover department at one point. And one of the ways that we got new talent was by finding comedians because comedians. Had the same job as a commercial voiceover artist, they just didn't know it. Yeah. They, you know, a voiceover artist has to hit certain words to you know, evoke an emotion from the listener.
Sure.
And that's the same thing a comedian has to do. The same way a VO artist has to hit a tagline, you know, Oppenheimer, The Right Way to Invest, Gene Hackman, you know, there's a way he says that. And we figured out that comedians have this automatic familiarity with language, right?
Yeah.
So I had the best job in the world. I got to go to comedy clubs for free, sitting in the best seats, in the industry seats, where they don't, the comedians know not to mess with you, basically.
Uh-huh.
They know that, you know. And then, you know, you get, then I would get to bring in people who later, you know, luckily would become somebody, you know. And I was really, it's funny, the one I remember that happened with the most was Bill Burr.
Uh-huh.
Bill was playing, I think it was Stand Up New York, and on the Upper West Side. And I went to see, you know, just random comics. And Bill was, I think, just starting out. This is, well, I don't know when Bill started, but this was 2000, 2001.
Uh-huh.
And he was an relatively unknown, and I had never heard of him. And I just said, this guy is tremendous. So I remember I went to the office the next day, and I told the agent, Tara, I said, you've got to call this guy in. He just knows how to use his mouth. And he's going to be natural behind the mic. He's going to be a natural. He does not have the, you know, an announcer voice. He does not have a movie trailer voice. It's not like that. It doesn't, VO doesn't have to be that. It just has to be in those words. And Bill knew how to hit the words. So I believe we called Bill in. I believe he came in. I ran into him outside of a bar in Brooklyn a few months ago. And I hadn't seen him. I mean, he doesn't know who I am.
Uh-huh.
I never said, oh, I'm going to call you. And I just had, you know, our agent called his agent, and that was it. You know, I said, listen, man, I seem to have a memory of calling you in to ICM around 2001. Can you remember, for the voiceover stuff, can you remember? He says, absolutely, I did that.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, okay. I said to myself, oh, great. You know, it was fun working with you. I may have directed you in the voiceover booth. I don't think I went into the whole thing about, oh, I called you in, but I, you know,
right.
Does he care at the end of the day, you know?
Uh-huh.
He's got his name shit on me. So, you know, but that was probably the best part of the job, was going and seeing all these amazing up and coming comedians.
That's fantastic.
You know, a lot of them dropped off the face of the earth, sadly.
Right.
But, you know, there's some really, you know, funny waiters out there. There's some really funny insurance brokers out there that, you know, just that never made it as stand-ups.
Yeah.
But they're the most fun to talk to.
Sure. Is there somebody now that we should be looking out for that we might not know about yet?
You got to email me ahead of time and say, Lee, I got to ask you this question. I got all these things in my head about, I'm trying to produce a movie here, man. Listen, let's go to America's Got Talent, because I love that show. I'm watching it now. Gary Veeder, he's brilliant. Brilliant. There was the comedian, forget if he won or not, last year, who had like the love affair with Heidi Klum. He was great. I could look it up if you want me to. Do you edit this after or
not? Sometimes.
Okay. Well,
I could tell people to look it up.
The guy who has, listen. Listener, is just Google America's Got Talent comedian Heidi Klum love affair. You'll get the guy. He's hysterical.
Sounds good.
Yeah, they're great. But Gary Veeder is terrific.
Awesome.
There's also a ventriloquist. I'm blanking on his name. He's an English guy who's also on AGT, and he does. I mean, and he actually does a great bit with Howie.
Where he basically
breaks away from traditional ventriloquism, where he's, you know, got the hand up the puppet's ass, where he basically steps away and he has a wireless, you know, controller for the mouth.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know, you almost think, how did nobody think of this before?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
That's fantastic.
And then he puts a remote-controlled sort of mask on the, you know, mouth mask on top of Howie's face.
Oh, yeah.
And he turns Howie into the dummy.
Those are fantastic, yeah.
It is. I mean, it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Side note, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the man who invented that, Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater, invented that mouth.
Really?
Yes. I don't think it was one of those things where he wasn't allowed to talk about it for years, because I don't know if he developed it for another company or if there were any lawsuits, but he wasn't allowed to talk about it. But very recently.
He developed the wireless mouth?
Yeah, he invented that.
Oh, I didn't know this. I figured that this guy just that's great.
Yeah, wow. the mouth rig is like, it's not used all that commonly, but commonly enough that he's made some money off of it. So yeah it's pretty interesting. I found that out recently.
It's MST3K, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. Got it. Yeah.
He's an underappreciated genius because he's a weird, quiet dude, but like he's invented a lot of things, but that's the one that's made him quite a bit
of
money.
The show is just brilliant.
Oh yeah, of course.
It's great.
So before we go, I want to make sure that we remind people again about the movie. So just give them the breakdown where they can find it online, like the trailer and all that stuff.
Yeah, go to backintimefilm.com. That will have the trailer, that'll have all the, you know, there's behind the scenes footage there. There's you know, just all the information you need is right there. There's a store there. You can buy the DVD or the Blu-ray there. All that stuff is available after October 21st. But October 21st, Future Day, is the day and date release for the film.
That's awesome. Yeah. I will just then remind people that go to millionmcflymarch.com. You will find, or go to writetostolendress.com. You'll find the information on the Million McFly March. Sign up, RSVP. You can do it in your own town if you want to do it. We haven't had a whole lot of people contacting me about that. That'd be great. You can go there. You can donate right to Team Fox. We're doing this in conjunction with Michael J. Fox's Team Fox, so you can donate there. We'll have a presence here in Burbank at the end of this month as well, so you can sign up there, donate money there. We made quite a bit of money at our street donations last month. So come out, just show some support. But the big thing, too, is also celebrate Back to the Future. We're all dressing up like Marty McFly. I'm wearing my costume from a drinking game. And that's kind of, this, the whole thing started originally was going to just be like a flash mob. But then eventually I was like, well, let's try and raise some money with it. So,
wait, are you wearing a costume right now during this interview?
Oh, God. You know what? I should have, but no. I do have it. I have it ready. I have that
sucker at the ready. Then I'll do the whole thing again on video. I'll give the same answers on video. Actually, I'll be better researched. So it's fine. Let's do it again on video. If I'm me, I'll put a shirt on.
Love it. So please, people, go watch this movie when it's out. Please come to the Million McFly March. Same thing at the March. I will make sure to mention this movie because, you know, it comes out at the same time. It's a lot of fun. It's something, you know, and also if you come to the March and you can't afford to give money, that's okay. There's no pressure to give, but if you can give, obviously do, because it's one of those, it's a research foundation where the money actually goes to the research, like actual, it's not just an awareness thing. They actually research Parkinson's and how to fix this shit. Go watch Back in Time. When it comes out, obviously. I will release this well in advance of that. Go to the Million McFly March. Lee, thank you so much for doing the show. Thank you for doing this.
This was a blast. I mean, I didn't ever think that I would get to talk about this in an interview, you know.
And, right. And
this is a blast. I'm thrilled. I'm glad to find another lover of comedy, you know, in the kinship here.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's nice when I find people on the show who've got stuff to say. Not that nobody does, but sometimes people are unprepared. So I'm glad that you were nice and prepared to talk about something you love this much. And also, if you're ever out in LA, please look me up because you should definitely do the show again.
Oh, definitely. I'll stop by. Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you guys for listening. Go check all that stuff out. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.